you think about temperature change, temperature increase. However, global warming has a profound impact on the rainfall, evaporation, and hydrologic cycle. And in a sense that this may be even more important issue in future, as the population seem to be moving from one place to another, usually they seem to go some dry, nice climate, and then consume huge amount of water, you know. And you just have to look at a place like Las Vegas or something like that. But exactly those places which are already begin to suffer from water shortage are very often the place where water is going to be even shorter as global warming proceeds. So today that is my topics which I'm going to cover today. And Dick Pelletier told me that I'm going to talk about general talk in Department of Physics. I better shape up. And usually these physicists are very unhappy if I don't explain to them why. In a logically consistent manner according to law of physics. Right? So that's what I'm going to do today. I may not succeed, but if you can satisfy, then you can ask a question at the end. This first picture is probably you see that any course at the beginning of climate, you see this. This planet Earth, radiant heat balance is satisfied by incoming shortwave solar radiation and outgoing infrared radiation, which is according to more or less Stefan Boltzmann's law, and which is the force power of the emission temperature. And these two balance each other so that Earth is maintaining its radiative equilibrium as a planet as a whole. And if you calculate the net incoming solar radiation and balance that with outgoing infrared radiation, you get temperature equilibrium temperature, which is minus 17 degrees centigrade. However, if you area average the temperature of the entire world, it is plus 15 degrees. So that the difference between the two is 32 degrees. That is the difference between emission temperature and actual temperature at the surface is 32 degrees. And this difference is attributed to greenhouse effects in the atmosphere. Now, what is the greenhouse gas in the atmosphere? The pioneer who first identified and measured these absorptivity of greenhouse gases is well-known Tyndall in the UK. And he's the first one to sort out this measurement. Now, so I will explain why then 32 degree difference comes out. Now, greenhouse gas in the atmosphere is only few percent of atmospheric compositions. Atmosphere, usually nitrogen and oxygen, is more than 98%. And argon, if you add argon, almost all, only few tenths of percent is greenhouse gases. What they are, water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane, etc. But it's a tiny fraction of atmosphere. But it's absorbed and emit according to, approximately according to Kirchhoff's law, emission and absorption. And this explains the greenhouse effect. This slanted line indicates vertical distribution of temperature schematically in the atmosphere. It goes down at about 6.5 degrees centigrade per kilometer as you go up higher. Now, if you have an infrared radiation, going from near the Earth's surface, major fraction of it is absorbed, except for some window radiation, we call it, absorbed before it reaches the top of the atmosphere. On the other hand, if infrared radiation is emitted in the upper part of the troposphere, and almost all of them survive to go to outside the atmosphere. So effective emission source of outgoing infrared radiation is somewhere in turn out to be mid-troposphere. And so that this oval red is effective source of outgoing radiation. And that temperature is minus 17 degrees centigrade, which balances with net incoming radiation. Now, but ground temperature is much warmer, 32 degrees warmer than that emission temperatures. And this is a greenhouse effect of the atmosphere. Now I'm talking about next thing, about talk about water vapor feedback of the atmosphere. So if you have, this is the original emission source of atmosphere, and it's balanced with net downward solar radiation, balances, upward infrared flux, balanced with this. Now, if you pump more CO2 in the atmosphere, atmosphere infrared opacity of atmosphere increases, thereby raising altitude of effective emission source from A to B. Now, emission is sigma T, the force of this temperature, so that it no longer balances net incoming solar radiation. In order to balance with that, you have to parallel shift from line 1 to line 2. That is a direct effect of carbon dioxide increase. Now, however, you have to realize the water vapor is in sharp contrast to carbon dioxide. It has a residence time of few weeks. So when temperature goes up, then saturation vapor pressure of air goes up. That means moisture holding capacity of air increases. So that usually if temperature goes up, absolute humidity of air goes up. And if water vapor is the most dominant greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, therefore your effective infrared opacity increase from here to here, that means you have to raise the temperature not from 1 to 2, but you have to raise it from 1 to 3. And this is what we call water vapor feedback, positive feedback effect of water vapors. Now, let's look at, now I'm going to explain why, if you have more, put more CO2 in the atmosphere, why hydrologic cycle changes. That is the basic physical, fundamental physical processes which affect hydrologic cycle. Now, suppose you increase CO2. I told you originally this goes, effective source of emission go higher, thereby raising or warming the atmosphere. Now, however, let's think about downward infrared radiation, which really controls all ground heat balance. Ground heat balance. And that is what controls the hydrologic cycle. If you have more energy to ground, you get more evaporation, etc. That's what I'm going to explain. So suppose if you have more carbon dioxide in the air, your infrared opacity of the atmosphere again increases, thereby lowering effective emission source of downward infrared radiation reaching the Earth's surface. And that means you have more infrared energy coming to the ground. Now, ground is usually emitted as black body. That means absorbed as black body. Again, we have the Kirchhoff's law operating here. Okay. So let's say, suppose you have that much more energy come to ground. What happens? Now, first I just draw the heat balance of ground. Net downward solar radiation is equal to upward flux minus downward flux of infrared radiation. This is net upward flux of infrared radiation and sensible heat and latent heat, which is evaporation. And this is essentially the heat balance of Earth's surface. Geothermal heat is tiny and negligible. Okay. So now, suppose you increase downward flux, which is this delta CO2Q, by increasing infrared opacity of atmosphere. This has to be balanced by the change in netward upward flux of infrared radiation, and the change in sensible heat, and the change in latent heat. And that, in order to maintain the balance, you put more heat in there, you have to get rid of it by these three processes. However, let's think about it. If you have if you increase the surface temperature, then, of course, from the surface, there is a Stefan Boltzmann's net upward flux of radiation. From the atmosphere, there is a downward flux of radiation. Usually, upward flux overwhelms downward flux, so net upward flux is positive. Now, you increase that surface temperature, you increase net upward flux, usually. However, in this case, if you increase the surface temperature, air temperature increases, water vapor, absolute humidity increases. That means you increase surface temperature, you end up slight increase in downward flux. So that net upward infrared flux of infrared radiation does not help getting rid of that additional heat coming downward. Okay. Now, what really does is, as indicated here, that this heat is balanced by sensible and latent heat. But because major fraction of Earth is really covered by wet ocean surface, and major fraction, even some continent is wet, so major fraction of that, this two flux is essentially sensible heat, a tiny fraction of latent heat. So that increase of downward flux due to the increase of CO2 is essentially balanced by the latent heat flux change, which is a change in evaporation. So that's why you pump more CO2 in the atmosphere, downward flux increases, almost all of them translate into the increase in evaporation, which in turn enhance the convective activity in the troposphere. So this is why, if you have a global warming, you have more intensified hydrologic cycle. You have more evaporation and more precipitation. That is a basic physical mechanism why the evaporation increases as you increase the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. Now, so much about this. I usually don't show any equation, but I saw the physicists, so they have equation, like, which I never liked it, but sorry about it. I will stop doing this. So now I am not showing equation. Instead, I'm showing box diagram. Okay. So the tool I am going to study this problem is so-called coupled ocean atmosphere land surface model. It consists of green boxes, which is called atmospheric general circulations. And coupled with it, there is a blue boxes, which is these three, which is ocean general circulation models. And then you have a continental, which is brown box, which is heat and water budget of continental surface. And this is a sort of, we solve initial value problem. So this thermodynamical equation predicts temperature, this predicts horizontal component velocity, and this predicts water vapor. The very fortunate thing is the atmosphere is paper thin, so it's not the vertical component of flow is computed by continuity equation. So it's a very simple three-dimensional equation of motion, thanks to very paper-thin atmosphere. But anyway, we do this. and atmospheric component, atmospheric general circulation model, is many of you may know, is a, which is used for daily weather forecasting. And I will briefly explain. This is global grid system used for this model. So you cover entire globe with this kind of grid system. At the center of each grid box, there's many layers of this grid box, actually, vertical direction. Center of grid box, you have velocity, temperature, water vapor, put these things in there, and thereby defining your initial condition for your weather forecasting. And then in a small increment of time, you go forward in time. And if you do that 24 hours, that is called one-day weather forecasting. Basically, that's what it is. And you have similar system in the ocean, and you compare, and then... Now, that's weather forecasting. Now, climate is a little bit different, but this is a cartoon of physical process which are contained in that coupled ocean atmosphere model. And usually, we start from isothermal atmosphere, maybe horizontally uniform temperature, stratified ocean, and kept going in time. We may use some acceleration technique because it takes too long. And then, even though you start from isothermal atmosphere at rest, isothermal ocean at rest, eventually it will settle down to very realistic structure of atmosphere ocean. What you get is cold deep water in the ocean, a much warmer upper layer of the ocean. You have a thermocline between them. And in the troposphere, in the atmosphere, you have a troposphere and almost isothermal stratosphere, which interact with each other. So that is, and in the atmosphere, you have a jet stream. So once you create a, on the computer, sort of state of coupled atmosphere, ocean, land surface system, then you start perturbing, you start pumping more CO2 in this model, and then see how temperature changes, how hydrologic cycle changes, and so forth. So that's a summary of what I'm going to talk about today, result from obtained from this model. Now, this first picture illustrates the geographical distribution of annual mean precipitation obtained from this model. And red upper one is simulated global distribution of temperature, the precipitation. Bottom one is so-called observed global mean distribution of precipitation. Area which is red is a place where precipitation is very meager and small, and the area which is blue is an area of large precipitations. And you can see, if you look at, say, something like southwestern desert, right here, and Sahara Desert, Gobi Desert, Central Asian Desert, Australian Desert, Kalahari Desert, Patagonian Desert, you can see these are the areas where precipitation is very meager. Also, you can look at equatorial rainfall and tropical rain belt. The very heavy precipitation region is pretty well reproduced. Now, although I say so, but if you look at detail, there is many things which is wrong about this simulation. But that's I'm not going to talk too much about it today. Now, start talking about it, probably I use up all my time you gave me. So that I'm not going to do it. Main point I'm saying is not perfect simulation. But you can see that this is good enough to begin to inquire the kind of question I just posed earlier time. So we did two sets of global experiments. First one, we did 8 global warming experiment. This kind of jargon is the thing. But basically what you do is you put the past change in greenhouse gases. There is an observation by using actual observation of atmosphere, look at the I scores, and you can see how greenhouse gas changed in the past, and then extrapolate the current increase rate into the future, which may be wrong, but this is considered to be sort of medium range scenario of future change in greenhouse gases, which is a little old, IS 92, so it's already 13 years old scenario, but not that much different in terms of total thermal forcing, what you have now. So then, CO2 contracting experiment. According to this scenario, CO2 equivalent to greenhouse gases doubled by 2050, middle of 21st century. And then there is another experiment which we did. This one includes sulfate. When you burn coal, SO2 gas comes out. And then that creates sulfate particles, thereby reflecting sunshine. So cooling effect. Now, that is included. Now, next one is extension of IS-92A scenario without sulfate. Probably, hopefully, many countries will, by end of 21st century or something, they may solve sulfate problem. So this may not be too bad. And then keeping increasing 1% per year CO2 equivalent greenhouse gases. If you do that, CO2 contracts year 2120. Okay. And then after that, we say it will go flat. Now that means, but then they say CO2 quadruple, that's maybe never happens, right? But many of the people estimate, according to their estimate, that unless you take very draconian measure, knowing how much coal is available, and knowing how people are burning coals, particularly in developing countries, that it's almost very likely that it will quadruple. So that this will not be such an outrageous scenario at all. So now then what happened if you do that? So this is a two experiment, the results which I'm going to show. And first I will show usually middle of 21st century, and then from this experiment I will show best guess of the 22nd century. So how water thing changes 21st, middle of 21st, and the middle of 22nd century. That's what I'm going to do here. Now this shows the first set of experiment and show how temperature increases and keep going up. And what is interesting here is precipitation also increases. This is the global mean precipitation, keep changing. There's a huge noise here, but force changes this smooth curve here. Then global mean precipitation also increasing steadily, as you can see, confirming earlier thing as I discussed earlier, both precipitation and evaporation increases by exactly the same amount because the atmosphere cannot keep water vapor too long. So first I will show you this, according to this scenario, this is not very different from major part of IPCC exercise, and even though I use a much older scenario here. And the upper one is how temperature increases middle of 21st century. Bottom one may be middle of 22nd century. And upper one, if you average that increase over entire globe, temperature increase about 2.3. However, if you look at this, over continent, actually, temperature increase between 2 and 5 degrees centigrade, as you can see. You can see the warming is much larger. Global mean is only 2.3, but over continent, temperature increase 2.5, depending upon latitude. Higher latitude, there's large warming. But why you have much more warming over continent than over the ocean? The reason for it is very simple. you know, the, when summer gets hot, then you sprinkle the water on the ground and you feel cool. That is because evaporation take up the energy. Evaporate, ventilation through evaporation cooling the surface. But if a continent very, very dry, you can't get rid of heat by evaporation. So you have to get rid of heat by sensible heat flux, bound heat turbulent flux of sensible heat. And in order to make up for the loss of evaporation, you have to have a much larger air-ground temperature difference in order to get rid of that additional heat. And that's why warming is much larger over continent than over the oceans. Now, bottom one is middle of 22nd century, warming is 5.3 degrees centigrade. However, if you look at over continent, warming is between 5 and 10, as you can see. It started approaching Jurassic Park. So this is huge because of the fact that temperature is much, warming is much larger over continents than the oceans. So now, get back to main talk, theme of this thing, the global mean warming by middle of 21st century of surface air temperature, 2.3, and the percentage increase of precipitation and evaporation. They are equal when average over entire globe, increase about 5.3%, and evaporation, of course, increase equal amount. And by the middle of 22nd century, 12.7%. So you say, all right, the 5%, yeah, that's not negligible, but it's not that bad. You know, so you increase that much, you know, just one order of 10% of the whole thing. Who cares about it? Or a runoff. Now, if precipitation falls uniformly and evaporation changes, go uniformly, then there's no river discharge because these two cancel. But as you know, precipitation has a huge spatial temporal variability. Evaporation tends to be much more uniform than precipitation. So that is why excess of precipitation over evaporation at one geographical location give you runoff. But even runoff, okay, the 17.5%, a little bit large, but yeah, maybe we can survive this kind of change. Now, what is interesting is geographical variability of these things. Some places get much more than this, as I show you later. Some places get the opposite sign, actually. So this is a change in river discharge. I will give you actually numerical value later. So all I would like to have you see is geographical distribution of change in the annually average river discharge. Where river discharge increase, maybe look at the 22nd century, it's more drastic here. So you see over Siberia, the blue is all over the place. That means quite over Siberia. Western Europe is large. Let's look at North America. Look at Canada. And northwestern part of Canada, my God, is there a huge increase in river discharge. And Canada as a whole is going to be, has been water rich already, but going to water rich even more. And that is what this indicates. But particularly Mackenzie and Yukon and all these places increased tremendously. And where is the other place where river discharge increased? Is that is a place where Indian summer monsoon region, where the heavy precipitation occurs in summertime, African heavy precipitation region, and then on the Amazonas river basin. These are the places where precipitation is heavy. You tend to get even much more river discharge. Now, what is the physical mechanism for doing this? It's a very simple explanations. And this is the middle of 21st century, so magnitude is not very large. I just asked to make 22nd century version But it's good enough to show what is happening. The precipitation seems to be increasing in high latitude in both hemispheres. And in the subtropics to this region, precipitation hardly changed. Some places even reduced. But and then right around the equator, precipitation increases here. So this is the big picture. Now what is happening is this. That is a water vapor. The water vapor evaporates a lot in the subtropical ocean. And what it does is atmosphere, the place where over Toronto, there is many cyclone waves moved from west to east, once a week time scale. These cyclone waves, what they do is southerly flow, bring warm, moist air northward. And then they have cyclone waves, there's a northerly flow, bring cold, dry air coming this way. That's why you get a warm spell, you get a cold spell. That warm spell is air is moist and usually rising motion, it's more saturated. That air coming northward. But behind the storm, dry air coming, southward. That means net transport of water vapor. Now, if you have warmer air, absolute humidity of air increases for the reason I explained earlier. Therefore, forward transport of water vapor by cyclone wave increases. Get rid of more water moisture from subtropical latitude, and then eventually that will dump that moisture in high latitude. That's why Canadian river discharge are going to increase very substantially. Now, from subtropics, a lot of evaporation goes on. Another thing is the trade wind. Trade wind transports moisture from subtropics towards the equator, where there is an intertropical convergence along rain belt, bring that. But if you have warmer air, again, absolute humidity of air increases, thereby increasing equatorial transport of moisture, thereby increasing precipitation over ITCG, but at the same time it depletes water vapor from subtropical somewhere between middle to low latitude. That place is getting dry. And then northern Canada and tropical heavy rain area, you start getting even much more rainfall. And that's a very simple explanation, but basically the atmospheric moisture, water vapor, basically controlled by Clausius-Clapeyron equation. And that's really controlled. The dynamical effect on the circulation is relatively small. Hardly cell intensity, hardly changes. Some model even weakened. so basically Clausius-Clapeyron equation too. So this shows that how the precipitation, dust line precipitation changes as a function of latitude, and how the at the tropics precipitation increases, and the evaporation is solid line, evaporation change, and the difference contributes to river discharge, as you can see. Because this is zonal average, the average over both continents and the oceans. Now this tells you how the precipitation changes in many rivers, and on the left you see the river discharge, and in bracket is actual observed river discharge. Now it's not perfect, unfortunately, but you can see that catchment with this 200 kilometer by 200 kilometer grid model, it doesn't resolve catchment very well, and so you would like to. As the computer gets faster, you would like to do it much, much finer mesh. Then, supposed to get much better agreement. But let's look at the Yukon 10 unit, and by the middle of 21st century, it increased 21%, and then middle of 22nd century, it increased by 47%. Same kind of thing as the Mackenzie, 21 to 40%. So Mackenzie River discharge is going to be huge. But not only in a high latitude continent, but northwestern part of the continent, particularly upslope of this Rocky Mountain to the west, you get a huge. And that is why this Columbia River is increased as much as 47% here. And look at Siberia, the Volga increased 59%, 25 to 59%. And what is interesting is Danube and Rhine, Elbe and so forth, chains of river, they actually start increasing like other rivers, but then fizzle, because as the river flows, the soil starts drying up in southern Europe. Now, I will discuss this later. If you look at Central Lawrence, now come to middle latitude, then river discharge is much smaller, you may notice. The gradually, moisture is just taken out in both ways and kind of depleted. Amur, Zambezi. However, Huang He, something happened here. I don't know how much I can trust it, this thing. But this is, you are talking about the limit of model resolution. So, Huang He is like this. But this is increasing because the flow coming from Tibetan plateaus. If you, the Huang He go around over China, but if you keep tracing back, it's go to the Himalaya, Tibetan plateaus. And so that happened in Tianjin, much more extreme way. For a while it's like this, but then towards the end, start increasing. This Paraguay, Uruguay river originate from tropical rain belt, even though they are further. And so, but anyway, in middle latitudes as a whole, it doesn't change that much. Doesn't increase. It's supposed to increase because more precipitation, but you get rid of moisture both ways, low latitude and high latitude, so doesn't increase very much. And then the Amazon River, you can see how big the river flow of Amazon is. Moderately huge. The 194 is observed, I don't know how accurate, observed river discharges through Amazon, but that's 194, and it increased 11 and 23%. Ganga Brahmaputra is the monsoon intensified in this model, and so that not only just larger absolute humidity of converging air, but it's a monsoon convergence itself intensified in this case, because continent warm up more than ocean, so that more monsoonal flow there, and it increases to something like this. But other tropical river hardly changes, as you can see. So summarizing what I found is like high latitude marked increase in the Arctic River, marked increase in Europe, northwestern coast of North America, and relatively small change in middle to low latitude. And then tropics, large increase, and Ganga, Brahmaputra, moderate percentage increase. Absolute value, Amazon increase is huge, but percentage-wise, it's moderate. And other rivers. So this is a summary of what I found. Now, talking about soil dryness. Now, this is a model simulated distribution of soil moisture. As you can see, absolute value doesn't mean much, but you can see where is a red area. Model seem to capture, at least basically, the southwestern part of North America, this arid region, Sahara, this is Arabian Peninsula, Central Asian desert to Gobi, Australian desert, and Patagonia and Patagonia here in Kalahari basically model capture these arid zone very well indeed. And this gives you a percentage change. So you divide the change by value of soil moisture itself. By doing it, see, if you do it, look at the absolute value, these arid zones cannot be very large change. But if you look at the percentage change, you can see what how it's changing. So this is why I look at the percentage change in annual mean soil moisture. So by the middle of 21st century, this is 10% line here. This is 20%, this red one. The soil moisture begin to change, but the annual mean soil moisture, in terms of this thing, it's not very large. But then, by the middle of 22nd century, you can see southwestern region soil moisture reduce up to 30-40%. Mediterranean coast of Europe, Middle East soil moisture reduced tremendously. Over northeastern China, west of Beijing, you get a large percentage reduction. In Australia, something like 40%. Sahel is dries up. So forth. Now, what is very interesting in this model, that all semi-arid region drying up, but very arid region like Sahara actually wetting, you may notice. And some other model, like new GFDL model, all arid, not only semi-arid region, arid region all dries up. And if my mechanism is simply operating, all middle latitude subtropical dry zone should all dry up. In my model, very dry desert doesn't go according to my rule. And I still honestly confess I don't know what's happening in my model. Now, if you look at the movies of Living Desert or something, occasionally you get a hot, hot desert air, and, you know, all these animals is waiting for rain to come, and dry day come, and then one day all of a sudden, big convection, huge flood, and I don't know how many of you look at that movies, but I think maybe that kind of thing happening, but I don't understand what's happening in my model, honestly speaking. Now, let's look at the seasonal breakdown. First, I want to explain why soil moisture is reducing. And you can see that in a semi-arid region, arid region, precipitation and evaporation are balanced with each other. And very little river discharge, runoff, is very small. These dry zones. So when precipitation changes, evaporation usually changes by same amount. Now, however, if the evaporation is equal to potential evaporation, which is the energy available for evaporation at Earth's surface, and factor, this is the oversimplified equation, but factored through fractional percentage of soil moisture to field capacity. So if soil is dry, soil is wet, almost every potential evaporation, radiation energy available for evaporation, go into evaporation. But on the other hand, if soil is dry, a major fraction of it is go to sensible heat. So suppose you precipitation change very little in from middle to low latitude, particularly subtropics, and potential evaporation increases. Only way to maintain this balance between precipitation and evaporation is to reduce the soil moisture. By making reduce soil moisture so that precipitation doesn't change, but still you put more energy. So how to balance, maintain this balance is to reduce soil moisture, to maintain the water budget state. So little change in precipitation, increase potential evaporation, and reduction in soil moisture as equilibrium balance. So let's look at the seasonal breakdown. And you can see already by middle of 21st century, if you look at in terms of season, then the change becomes substantial, disturbing. If you look at annual mean, it wasn't bad, but now it looks bad. Particularly, for example, in the winter time, this will go up to 30-some% here. Australian one go up to 30-some% in June, July, August. And in December, southwestern part of the semi-arid zone go down up to 25%. Beijing go up to 25% and so forth. One of the interesting things which related to Canada is that summer drying and winter wetting in middle to high latitude continent, particularly it's a big effect in Siberia. Now, why this is happening is very interesting. If you increase sea surface temperature, evaporation from ocean increases, but over continent, warming is much larger than over the ocean. So by the time it gets to continent, relative humidity is reduced because warming is larger over continent. So that the precipitation actually reduces because of the increase of relative humidity, which is due to larger surface temperature increase because of dryness. And that's why precipitation is, precipitation is reduced. And furthermore, these snow melt season become earlier, so that summer to spring to summer drying of soil moisture begins earlier, thereby making summer soil moisture even drier. And for these reasons, over Canada and Siberia, soil moisture is much drier during summer season, and then wetter in winter, because even though temperature goes up, surface temperature is so damn cold. Saturation vapor pressure doesn't hardly increase. Clouds, if you know clouds, clouds is properly equation, exponential. So near low temperature, saturation vapor pressure hardly changes with temperature. So evaporation doesn't increase, but precipitation increases because evaporation from surrounding ocean increases. So precipitation increases. That's why it's getting dry, wetter. Now, what is really shocking one is this, what happens in seasonal breakdown in terms of soil moisture change. Now, one of the things is, if you look at middle of 22nd century, look at the Mediterranean coast, soil moisture is reduced as much as 50% or more in summertime. And the summer dryness, summer dryness is rather amazing here, almost like 40-50% here, and over Canada 30-some%. And if you June, July, August is the winter in the southern hemisphere, here about 40-some% here, 30-some% over Australia. And winter in northern hemisphere, southwestern part of the U.S., it go up to 40%. Drying in winter and so forth. So it's all of these are the water is crucially important for agricultural reason. Plenty sunshine, soil is very fertile, and it's a very intensive agricultural region. So that in my opinion, that if global warming is harmful to human race, that water problem is more than even temperature. That's what, maybe temperature we can put air conditioning in there. But the water is much, much harder. So that's what very interesting issue. So this is summary of my talks and, doing just right, I think. And semi-arid region reduction during much of the year, particularly during dry season. And gradual expansion of desert. Now, desert, center of desert itself gets wetter, a tiny amount wetter. But then, all surrounding regions get drier. desert doesn't get wet enough to be not being in the desert. But surrounding region are getting drier, so that means outward expansion of desert. And from middle to high latitude over Canada, a reduction in summer, increase in winter. But Canada is going to get, as I told you earlier, much more water. So you may have to give to U.S. More than Canadian dry whiskey. This last picture. I think how this soil moisture, suppose I say soil moisture is reduced by about 20-some% by the latter half of 21st century. But this is a running mean of long term, 20-year running mean. This is a control, black line is controls integration soil moisture of southwestern part of North America. We average over very extensive region. And then proto time series. Black one is this annual mean soil moisture time series. Reddish one is annual mean thin line soil moisture time series of global warming experiment. So when you get a 25% change in soil moisture, but this magnitude is than variability of annual mean soil moisture. And you can explain this by Langevin equation again. You force soil moisture by white noise rainfall, and you get this red noise soil moisture time series, essentially. But anyway, this is model producing. And so you can see what the consequence of it is. By happening this, you get more frequent extreme drought. Basically, that's what it is. But during this time, still you get a very wet year. And if you read this, Steinbeck novels or something, Grape of Wrath or something. Now, at that time, not every year is terribly dry. Some year may be average dryness. So that is what happening here. That is the manifestation of it is more like more frequent drought. But that doesn't exclude that some year it's getting much wetter even. And so this is the thing that some years ago in Europe, Mediterranean region, exactly the region where this model drying up. You get a big drought in Mediterranean. It's hot summer. Some people may have been in southern Europe on that year. And then a newspaper reporter asked the expert, is this global warming? And how you answer is a very delicate issue. But you can't say this is global warming because so long as natural variability is so much larger than the global. But basically what it says is drought is getting more and more frequent in this semi-arid region. Thank you. I think that it's very difficult to say that. The accuracy have, if I classify them, two sources. One is the scenario of greenhouse increase in future. Now, this is probably more difficult to predict that. In principle, it's much more difficult. Right? And so that is a major fraction of inaccuracy. And another one is a model sensitivity. Even though you have a perfect future prediction of radiative forcing of climate, if more sensitivity for given unit increase of radiative forcing, how much more the warm up? That's another one which called, we call climate sensitivity. And there are the two kinds of source of energy. And the former one is, as good as the scenario prediction, I can't say anything about it. In terms of latter one, is this model happened to have the sensitivity of all, about medium value of all climate model which currently available. By looking at this, by saying that, so, since this is, I'm a middle of it, so I must be right. I can't say that, obviously, right? Now, however, one of the interesting tests of the model, there are many other tests, which I have been spending a lot of time to think about, how to evaluate how good the sensitivity of a climate model, how realistic they are. The one of the very good thing is Dr. Peltier's working, something like a last glacial maximum. Temperature was much, much colder. And now, temperature is what you are now. So glacial to interglacial contrast of temperature is quite large. Fortunately, we know how much CO2 concentration at last glacial maximum by looking at the air bubble trapped into Antarctic ice sheet. So you can plug that in the model. And then, thanks to the effort of Dr. Peltier, that you can deconstruct how the ice sheet was at last glacial maximum. So then, if you know the distribution of ice sheet, and you know the approximate reflectivity of ice sheet, it's very shiny, reflect major fraction of sun, you can include that effect in this model, and then see, can we reproduce glacial interglacial contrast of temperatures? And there is a various way to determine the temperature difference. One of them are looking at taxonomic composition of plankton. And if you look at them, you see model is doing the model which is about 3 degrees for doubling CO2 is doing very well in reproducing glacial interglacial contrast of temperature. Now this doesn't mean we understand why CO2 was so low at the glacial maximum, why exactly ice sheet grown so much at that time. The Dick may know, say that he knows the reason. And so let him speak some other time. And he loves to do that, I'm sure, although he's shaking his head that way. And so question. That, I think, is, yeah.
Roland, I have an agricultural question.
Yes.
One of my worries is if the rain areas are shifting, and you look at the United States, the most productive agricultural areas are from, let's say, from Indiana to Iowa, where you have the rain park.
Yeah. Right?
He would have a hell of a problem.
Yeah.
Can you make any predictions on those movements of the rain?
Now, what I show here is if you look at the soil moisture, rain the same way it goes actually, you see that all the way from Midwest to United States to entire Canadian region to the south of permafrost region, everywhere going to be drier in summer, wetter in winter. This is in contrast to these lower latitude where moisture is getting away from it. But these regions are summer dry and winter wet. Since to the degree you do all the agriculture during warm season. Isn't this serious?
This is a problem in the fairies. I want some calculation.
Yes.
They would require
require 45 micromolar. Yeah, but yeah, this is the thing is the same way because of more downward flux of radiation, so that if you, for example, want to irrigate, then irrigated water evaporates faster, right? Because higher saturation vapor pressure. So you need more more irrigating water. The same way you would like to have more rain. And so what I said in, for example, lower latitude, rain doesn't change. But the problem is you have more potential evaporation, more radiation energy. And as CO2 increases, more downward flux, more energy for evaporation. So you need more precipitation in order to maintain same level of soil moisture, right?
So let's take this one more question.
Sure, yeah. I was wondering, you have made some simulations for about 150 years.
Yes.
Have you taken this from the solar activities and also Milankovitch cycle effects from the...
No, this one doesn't have it. But then Dick just telling me that this so-called foremost expert of solar reconstruction now say it's one quarter as large, so practically effect of solar fluctuation is negligible if our latest estimate were correct.
Four times smaller than the original estimates.
There is some, she was originally giving us substantial, non-negligible, small but not negligible magnitude of insulation fluctuations. But I don't think that now that she's saying it's one quarter as large, that means negligible for these fluctuations.
Well, let's thank Susan. You got to work. Lovely.